Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the burgeoning political scandal in New Jersey following the release of emails from Governor Christie's deputy chief of staff that indicate the governor had advanced knowledge of a traffic nightmare on the George Washington Bridge that appears to have been engineered as political retribution by Christie's staff against a mayor who did not back his re-election. An expert on New Jersey's rough-and-tumble politics, Ruth Mandel, the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, joins us to get some clarity on whether this Republican frontrunner for president in 2016 is, as the headlines proclaim, the bridge troll. Then we will speak with Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRLC-FM in Salt Lake City, who has been named by the Salt Lake Tribune as the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. We will discuss the uncertainty in Utah for 1,300 gay married couples now in legal limbo following the Supreme Court stay on same-sex marriages in the state while Utah appeals a lower court ruling allowing the unions. Then finally, while Republicans in Congress have tried repeatedly and unsuccessfully to kill health care reform, we will examine the success of Republican obstruction of Obamacare at the state level, where thanks to the Supreme Court decision, governors are free to decline federal Medicaid money and not create health care exchanges. Theda Scotchpole, a professor of government at Harvard University, whose latest research for the Scholar Strategy Network illustrates how partisan ideology has suppressed enrollment under the Affordable Care Act, joins us to discuss the impact and human cost on millions of people in 23 states who are being denied health care because of petty political spite. Joining us now is Ruth Mandel, the director of the Eagleton Institute for Politics and the Board of Governors Professor of Politics at Rutgers University. A founder and director of Eagleton Center for American Women and Politics. She is the author of numerous publications about women's changing political roles, including In the Running, The New Woman Candidate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Mandel.
Thank you very much.
And apropos your book, Ruth Mandel, In the Running, The New Woman Candidate, of course, it's no secret that Hillary Clinton is likely to be a presidential candidate in 2016. It's also no secret that Governor Christie is likely to be a presidential candidate in 2016. So tell me, how much is this burgeoning scandal, now known as Bridgegate, likely to affect his chances?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens in the next few days and in the weeks that are ahead of us. But at the moment, it looks like a very serious threat. He certainly has an enormous crisis on his hands. And how he handles it is going to tell everything about his path forward. He's certainly interested in, everyone here assumes that he's interested in pursuing the nomination. This is the first time that the governor has faced anything like, I mean, he's faced many challenges before, both on the policy side and on the political side, but this is the first time that he's faced anything this big and this dangerous and potentially damning.
And in the statement that was released late Tuesday afternoon on his official website, he says – he used the words, "It's unacceptable, I'm outraged, I'm deeply saddened, it's completely inappropriate, unsanctioned conduct, made without my knowledge, et cetera, et cetera." But earlier, he had, in effect, gone along with a cover story saying that the bridge closures were a part of a kind of traffic drill. So is that going to come back to haunt him, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, in this day and age, everything one has ever said, done, worn, smiled at comes back to haunt you. So everything is recorded, and even in the coverage so far, which has been amazing, I think it's been a lead story in every program so far this evening. There have been clips from some of his statements that are going to be problematic for him to reconcile with what he's saying today. The record is there of some of the things that he said, which is true for everybody who's running for office. I mean, that's the climate today. It's the situation for political people.
Well, but, you know, already it's been called, Bridgegate. But, yeah. You know, the mother of the gates, of course, was Watergate.
Right.
And what happened at Watergate was that the minions were sacrificed first, and then eventually it gets up to the big guy, right?
Right. Yeah, right. And we will see. I mean, this is really, despite how big this is today, it's a fairly early stage of unfolding. More will happen tomorrow. And the governor, I think something really so far that's very important is that for most of today, he did not respond and no one knew what he was going to say. And everyone was waiting for him to come forward. When he did come forward at the end of the day, he made a statement, but he did not stand himself in front of the cameras and the microphones. He didn't take press questions. He didn't hold a press conference. He issued a statement. He, in the statement, I'm sure you're familiar with it, said that what happened was unacceptable, that he was outraged, that he had been misled. All of that being true, he really needs to get up himself in public and respond to questions. And so that has yet We have yet to see what happens. There's a lot of investigating that has to be done. Unfortunately for him, even if he's being 100% candid, and he's a man who likes to be candid and is very proud of how direct he is, even if he is being 100% candid, honest in this statement, there are going to be lots of questions about it, his credulity. It makes him look, if he didn't, for example, if he didn't know what was going on at all, then there are going to be questions about, well, how could you not have known? He's a very strong leader. That would make him look weak. His message has been that he's in charge. If this is true, how could his staff have operated without his knowledge? He's going to have to deal with those kinds of questions. If they did operate without his knowledge, how can people have confidence in what he says is strong leadership, and it has been. I mean, there's been tremendous loyalty on the part of people who work for him, and he's had a very, very tightly run administration, something that many of our media people in New Jersey have commented on. So the message has been controlled, and people have been very unified, and his staff has always been enormously supportive of him and loyal in ways that people have remarked on.
Again,
so
I'm
put some cracks in all that.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Ruth Mandel, the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics and the Board of Governors, professor of politics at Rutgers University, a founder and director of Eagleton Center for American Women and Politics. She's the author of numerous publications about women's changing political roles, including In the Running, The New Woman Candidate. So what we know, though, so far is pretty, well, it's almost like sort of mafia behavior in a way. It's certainly very petty, creating a traffic nightmare for several days on the George Washington Bridge, the main entree into New York City. It appears to be engineered as political retribution by Christie's staff against a mayor who did not back him for re-election. And, of course, he won so handily, I don't even know why they needed to do that. What's your sense then of go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's of course one of the ironies here. Whether he was involved or not, it didn't really need to be done. One of his central messages has been that he is a bipartisan leader, and so yes, he wanted support endorsement from a Democratic mayor. On the other hand, there were many Democrats, many mayors who did endorse him in this campaign. And the other, so the mayor of Fort Lee was certainly, there were many other Democrats who did, and the mayor of Fort Lee was not crucial to his reelection. In addition to that, the community of Fort Lee voted for him. So it's a really ironic and sad thing. Fort Lee was not crucial in any way. His people didn't need to do this. At the moment, I think we're facing that classic with him. What did you know? When did you know it? He has in his first term, he's entering a second term and an inauguration very soon. as governor, will have to reassure the New Jersey citizens that his concern is to protect and work for them, and that he's capable of leading the state in their interest. He's always expressed that message, and I think, you know, that is the message that they will want to hear, and that's the message he'll need to deliver in a credible way. As a national figure, he's going to have to introduce himself as someone who's capable of handling this level of political crisis, this kind of national attention. What happened in Fort Lee is somewhere between, I'm not sure what yet, someone here has said that it'll be a Saturday Night Live episode, and I'm sure it will be, but something in between, you know, absurd mischief, scoundrel behavior, sort of at one extreme, and at another, threatening, very threatening to people. It could have, in some ways, he's lucky that people didn't die as a result of this, that we are hearing now that some first responders couldn't get through during these traffic jams. Fortunately, as far as we know so far, there's been no tragedy as part of it, but it nonetheless is inexplicable that something at this level would have been done. And I'd have to say also that governing is different from campaigning, and the people who were working for him in roles in the government should have known what it means to govern as opposed to what it means to work in a campaign, and they stepped over many, many lines here.
And much of this evidence that's come out is in the form of emails within the Christie staff, one of whom is going to be testifying, I believe, tomorrow before the New Jersey legislature. When you say, Ruth Mandel, that there weren't any victims, of course, one of the emails indicates...
Well, there were, yeah.
Yeah, one of the emails indicate that one of the Christie's officials referred to the kids that were missing school, because after all, starting on September the 9th, 4 days of gridlock paralyzed this bridge. And this gridlock was created by... on purpose, and Christie himself said that it was a part of a fictional traffic study. But the long and the short of it is that one of the emails of one of his officials referred to the kids that can't get to school as, these are the children of Buono voters. And, of course, that was Barbara Buono who ran against him, who he trounced. So,
there were many, many foolish and irresponsible comments made, and because these messages were subpoenaed and these have now become public, we get a glimpse at the kinds of conversations that probably go on every day at every level that are really embarrassing and sometimes damaging and certainly not up to the standards of anything we would expect of public officials. But what I meant by nobody being damaged is that, thank goodness, at least as far as we know, we haven't heard of some tragedy that resulted from this. That is not in any way to suggest that this was not a terrible thing for the people who suffered the consequences of these delays and the cost to the town and so forth. I'm sure the governor would feel the same way. I do think he cares about the citizens, and I do think that his performance during the period after our Superstorm Sandy, which is what endeared him to so many people here in New Jersey, I do think that that's right at the heart of what he cares about. But this has raised a lot of other questions about the people who serve him and about what he has allowed to happen in the circle of people around him. And he's going to have to deal with that now.
And one of his deputy chief of staff, Bridget Ann Kelly, wrote on an email saying, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. And the reply came from David Wildstein, the governor's appointee to the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which controls the George Washington Bridge. He said, got it. Now, he's the guy that's going to be testifying tomorrow before the legislature. What do you expect to happen there, Ruth?
Well, first of all, as far as I understand, his attorney is going to try in the morning to prevent that. So we don't know if he's going to be testifying. The legislature is intending to have him testify, but we just don't know that yet. So we'll see what happens if he has to testify tomorrow. But if you could draw a line, I think this is really important. I mean, if you could draw a line and say that his behavior and Kelly's behavior was both irresponsible and foolish and overzealous on behalf of someone that they're devoted to. And this is true, by the way. I mean, it's important for people, I think, to understand. It probably ultimately is irrelevant in this situation, but important for people to know, and I've seen this time and time again, there are people who are extremely loyal to the governor. They care about him. They're loyal to him. They've worked with him for years. And they're willing, they're obviously willing to do things that they shouldn't be doing. And whether or not he has sanctioned that is something that he's going to have to, you know, he has said he did not, and he's going to have to stand behind that and in some way convince people that that's true. But these are people who were just, I have no idea what animated or what made, you know, started all of this, but they're not the kinds of people who should be on the public payroll because they have terrible judgment, and they're making political decisions and bad political decisions in situations in which we're talking about governing and not about politics and petty retribution.
So, Ruth Mandel, again, the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics and the Board of Governors, Professor of Politics at Rutgers University. The governor is going, he is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association. He's due to tour the nation in this role. I imagine it's like those press conferences at the White House when a visiting head of state arrives, and if there's a scandal du jour, that whoever that person and that country that's represented there in the White House gets short shrift, and all the reporters want to know about the scandal. Is that going to happen to Christie? I mean, he can't duck this. Obviously, he's ducked it for most of the day, and as you say, he didn't show up today, but presumably he's going to...
The national political scandal for him, and it's first and foremost what he has to deal with, and until he deals with that in a way that puts it to rest, is acceptable to people, if he can do that, if he can get beyond it, then he can go back to not only governing New Jersey. I mean, he's just been reelected. He's about to be inaugurated again for his second term. So there's a lot of attention at home, of course, to his service as governor. But in his role at the Republican Governors Association, there are a whole other set of decisions that will have to be made nationally, not only on his part, but by governors around the country who will be depending on him to come in and support and help them in their states. And, of course, the outcome here, as this unfolds, will affect that. If you're the governor of another state and Governor Christie is coming in, you want him to come in as someone strong and not someone who's been weakened in a devastating way by this scandal.
By this butterbing politics, right? That's what it feels like. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Ruth Mandel.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ruth Mandel, the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics and the Board of Governors, professor of politics at Rutgers University. She's a founder and director of Eagleton Center for American Women in Politics and is the author of numerous publications about women's changing political roles, including In the Running, The New Woman Candidate. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go to Salt Lake City to look into the legal limbo that 1,300 gay married couples are now in. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He's a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune recently named as the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and is a producer of TLC's Breaking the Faith, which is about Mormon polygamist youth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Troy Williams.
Hey, Ian. So good to be back with you. Hi, L.A.
And this time we're not talking about Mitt Romney or the Mormon Church. you can't not talk about Utah and somehow not talk about the Mormon Church. But let's begin with this Supreme Court stay that has 1,300 married gay couples in legal limbo.
Right.
And it seems that this Supreme Court stay is in effect while the state of Utah appeals a lower court ruling allowing the union. So walk us through these steps of how the state referendum and the lower court ruling and the chronology, if you will.
Sure. Let's back up. 5 years ago, consider this. The state of Utah was intimately involved in sponsoring, financing, and organizing your Proposition 8, right?
Mm-hmm. So we in know California, that, right, yes.
Exactly. And we knew that millions of dollars were flowing from the state of Utah into California. And when we discovered this, Utah's LGBT community, we were mortified. We were ashamed. And we sprung into action. We organized, we rallied, we litigated, and 5 years later, we brought marriage equality to the reddest Mormon state of Utah. So number one, that's phenomenal, and we're pretty excited about that, okay? So backing up, you know, in 2004, 66% of Utah voters approved Amendment 3 to the state constitution, which stated that marriage consists of only the legal union between a man and a woman, and that no other domestic union would be recognized as a marriage or given the same substantial equivalent legal effect. So we had plaintiffs that sued the state. The case was brought to a federal judge, Robert Shelby. The state defended Amendment 3, and they lost. And what Robert Shelby, what he argued was that, yes, Utah has the right to define marriage, but he also argued that the definition still has to fit within the U.S. Constitution. Amendment 3 doesn't do that. So what he declared, formally what he wrote was that the court declares the Amendment 3 to be unconstitutional because it denies the plaintiffs their right to due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So this is epic for us. This is the first time a judge is saying that individuals, LGBT individuals, have the constitutional right to marry who they love, and a majority of voters do not have the power to strip away the rights of minorities by referendum. The 14th Amendment protects us from the tyranny of the majority.
Well, I don't understand then, Troy Williams, why it is that the federal judge in Utah, Robert Shelby, based his decision on the Supreme Court's arguments that such bans violate gay and lesbian couples' civil rights, and that is why he decided the way he did, and yet it's the Supreme Court who's put the stay, obviously right, at the behest of the state of Utah. So what...
What's really epic about this whole thing is that the state fumbled the ball. The Attorney General's office did not even request a stay. Now, this is a beginning law school blunder, all right? The state was inept, and so usually when you are in these kinds of court cases, as I'm told, you know, you actually ask the judge, will you stay the ruling until this we have the chance to appeal? They didn't do it. So our district attorney, Sim Gill, and the Salt Lake City mayor, Ralph Becker, they said, there's no stay here. Let's do it. And they started issuing marriage licenses. And in just 17 days, we've had over 1,300 gay and lesbian couples get married. And it's been so beautiful here. I mean, I've seen the footage when Mayor Newsom was his act of civil disobedience back in the day was issuing marriages in San Francisco. And I've seen these footage of these happy couples with their crying and just hugging. And we experienced that here in Utah, and it was so beautiful and so transcendent. The joy that was just coming out of the Salt Lake County City Building was incredible. And our mayor came down and started marrying people, and it was just stunning. It was so beautiful.
So what then happened?
Well, this is the state, the Attorney General's office, which really has been in complete disarray because a week prior, our Attorney General, a smarmy guy named John Swallow, had to step down because he's deep in ethics violations, okay? Allegedly, he's got shady dealings with all kinds of unsavory characters, and he was facing an imminent impeachment. So he stepped down, leaving the AG's office in complete disarray. So then they were like, they requested a stay of the Tenth Circuit Court, and the Tenth Circuit Court sent it back and said, you gotta ask Shelby first. Then they requested a stay of Shelby, and Shelby said no. Then they went back to the Tenth Circuit Court twice, and both times the Tenth Circuit Court said, no, we're not going to stay the ruling. Then they took it to the Supreme Court, who on Monday, they actually granted Utah's request for a stay. So now we are now basically, according to Governor Gary Herbert, he said that now all of these marriages are on hold. They're not voided. They're just on a hold in a kind of legal limbo until the higher courts decide. So that's where we're at right now. And I see it as another major blunder for the governor's office because it shows the very real harm that will come to queer families who don't have the protection of marriage. Because we were seeing couples now filing joint taxes, applying for partner health benefits. Many of them were in the process of legally adopting children for the first time. And now that's been stalled. I think it's cold-hearted and it's ruthless on the part of Governor Gary Herbert.
And again, I'm speaking with Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He's a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune named as the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He appears in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and is a producer on TLC's Breaking the Faith, which is about Mormon polygamous youth. So, Troy, let's since we mentioned the Mormon Church there, which is inescapable, right? When you're talking about Utah and Utah politics, Utah was one of the last states on the continental U.S. to join the Union, and a part of the resistance was that Mormon leaders were forced to adopt a state constitution declaring polygamy and plural marriages forever prohibited. And you know that there have been lots of breakaway polygamous sects, and you work on that on the TLC program, Breaking the Faith. So you certainly know a lot about this. So you have that incident, which goes back in history some time. And then you have, of course, Utah's ruling on AIDS at the height of the AIDS crisis. The state passed a law which was since overturned, barring people with AIDS from marrying and nullifying marriage as a partner if a partner had the disease. So there's a history here of marriage and judicial rulings in the state of Utah, obviously.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that this decision by Judge Shelby came about a week after a U.S. District Judge guy named Clark Waddups ruled that the state can't ban consenting adults from actually living together in a conjugal relationship. Now, our bigamy statute was what we were using to persecute polygamous families living in the state, and it's why Cody Brown, who is the patriarch of the TLC show Sister Wives, picked up his family and moved to Nevada. And he actually filed against the state because there was rumblings that the state was going to come after him and his family. So he actually brought this case forward, and the judge ruled in Cody Brown's favor. Now, what's different about polygamous marriages and the legality of this is that when you talk to polygamous families, most of them are libertarians. They don't necessarily want legal recognition for their multiple wives. They really just want their lifestyle to be decriminalized. And I think that any time that we do something that helps a marginalized people come out of the shadows, that's a good thing. We have 30,000 polygamous families living in Salt Lake Valley. Okay, this is the capital county. And they shouldn't live like they are outlaws. And in situations like with the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that's featured on Breaking the Faith, you know, we do see lots of child abuse. We have seen really horrific abuses. They need to feel like it's safe for them to come out into mainstream society and access the services that we have to offer them, whether it's public schools or it's a domestic abuse shelters or support. And I hope that by this being struck down, that by this decriminalizing of polygamous families, that polygamous families that are in abusive situations will feel like they can come into mainstream society and get the help they need.
Well, but aren't this polygamy is not without its consequences and without its problems, right? I mean, a lot of the young girls that become the new brides of these polygamous men, none of whom I've seen on television look anything like George Clooney, I might add. They are sometimes only 13 years old. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if you were to bring these people out from the shadows, there still has to be rules, surely, for society.
Well, you know, absolutely. And we have to do everything we can to protect young people and to actually offer support for these families. Because marrying off a 13-year-old girl or a 14-year-old girl is absolutely unacceptable. And what we see in the FLDS, now not all polygamists are the same, and that's a very important distinction. There are more mainstream polygamists that live in the suburbs, and you wouldn't know that they were different to look at them.
Well, we saw that in the HBO series. We're all familiar. Yeah. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, Big Love did a beautiful job of showing the different kinds of polygamists. And there are many in this valley who send their kids to public schools, who pay their taxes, they're good, upstanding citizens. They just have this theological belief in a patriarchal marriage structure. So this is all, you know, revealed by the prophet Joseph Smith back in 1830s. He's the one that kind of started all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream LDS church has done their best to distance themselves, but these fundamentalist Mormons are trying to maintain and perpetuate the original teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. And some people are sincere in their religious devotion. Some women enter into plural marriage without coercion, but there are many who don't, and that's really the issue that we have to that's what we have to take issue with.
Well, I'm interested in the sense that, you know, that gay marriages are being punished by a state because of its reactionary attitudes, and
right.
At the same time we're saying, well, maybe we should be more lenient on plural marriages, and
they haven't touched the plural marriage issue.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they're coming after the gays, they're trying to hurt our families, but they've been mum on polygamy, and that has not gone unnoticed by us here.
Oh, I see. So you're the one that's calling for a little more tolerance and restraint and understanding here. But in effect, what's going on with the authorities, the church people who are clearly and the politicians and the governor who are behind this
yeah.
ban on gay marriage? They are turning a blind eye to polygamy. But you were telling us earlier that the polygamous families live underground.
Right. They do. And some of them do. Not all of them do. And we're seeing more of them, like with Sister Wives on TLC, we're seeing more of them coming out and sharing their lives with people. And, you know, I don't believe that there's anything untoward happening in Cody Brown's family. They seem like a happy family, and I believe that's accurate. I do know plural families that are great people, and I don't want to marginalize all of them. But I've also seen extreme abuses in polygamous scenarios, particularly in the FLDS communities that you can see on Breaking the Faith on TLC. There is extreme abuse happening there, and we really have to do everything that we can to make them, help these families feel safe, to feel welcomed, that they can come to the state and access state services that might help them out of their abusive situation.
So back to the the stay on gay marriage, where you've got 1,300 gay and lesbian married couples in limbo now.
Right.
What, Troy Williams, what in the last few minutes, what's the next step? I take it you're not taking this lying down.
No way. You're going to see the LGBT community rise up like never before. We got rallies planned. I'm even hearing rumblings today of a class action lawsuit. I mean, the state just raked in $59,000 in marriage license fees. All right. And so what's going to happen there? You know, are they welching on the deal here? We signed a contract with you. We paid money for this. And now you're backing out? No way. You're going to see the LGBT community organize like ever before. And here's the consequence, okay? We're going to take this to this is being appealed to the 10th Circuit Court in Denver. We're going to go there and we're going to win. And then that will be appealed again by the state all the way to the Supreme Court. We're going to argue there and we're going to win. And when we win, our case, we hope, will be the case that strikes down all the remaining 30-some anti-gay marriage bans in other states, effectively making gay marriage legal in all 50 states. Then we will all see that happen within the next year or two. So that's what the consequences are of this case, and we're going to fight all the way, and we're going to be fighting for every single state that has a marriage ban, and we're going to bring marriage equality to the entire nation.
But Troy, you're up against a fairly formidable force in the Mormon Church. You mentioned that they financed Proposition 8 here in California. They scuttled the ERA. It almost became a constitutional amendment, but for the intervention of the Mormon Church.
That's right. You're right.
And they've also kept denial of abuse in the Boy Scouts under wraps forever because they dominate the Boy Scouts. So. You're taking on a very reactionary group there.
You bet we are. But, you know, who would have ever thought 5 years ago that we would have brought marriage equality to Utah? And so this is my message to all activists out there. I don't care if you're working on immigration reform, if you're working on climate justice issues. If you get discouraged and you get worn down and you think that the obstacles are too great, I want you to remember this phrase: we brought marriage equality to the state of Utah. And we're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Mormon Church, you know, I think what I'm seeing is that when you talk to Latter-day Saints who are under the age of 30, they don't want this battle anymore. You talk to Republicans and Evangelicals, they don't want this battle anymore. They love their gay friends, they love their gay family, and they are marching with us. I have so many Mormon friends that are on board fighting with us, and they're the ones that are going to create change within the LDS Church. You watch it happen.
But isn't it a church run by octogenarians?
Absolutely, and they're completely out of step with the will of their members. And you know, and thankfully, they have taken a back seat with all of this. I think that they can see the writing on the wall. They know which way the wind is blowing, and I think that if you could get them to speak honestly, they know they've lost.
So is this a case really of not so much the Mormon Church being behind it, but these reactionary politicians like your governor, and you've also got that incredibly right-wing senator Mike Lee who won in a caucus, for God's sake, against toppling a very conservative senator Bennett. It looks like he's been a little chastened by the government shutdown. Is he being as loud and obnoxious as usual?
No, there's so much rumblings in the mainstream Republican Party to oust him when his time is up, and he is not popular here. And I would be very happy to support a moderate Republican. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud and on radio. I would be happy to support a moderate Republican to replace a fanatic, a Tea Party fanatic like Senator Mike Lee.
So, just in closing, then, Troy Williams. When do you start hitting the streets with your demonstrations?
Friday at the Capitol, at our state Capitol Rotunda. We have got a big rally planned. We've got a big giant wedding reception that we're doing on Saturday. We've got the Sundance Film Festival coming in the week after, and so there's lots of action going on there with a great marriage equality film about Prop 8, actually. And so we're going to keep all of these stories on the front page. And this is where Governor Herbert has really screwed up, is because now, you know, all of these LGBT families have suffered these indignities in silence. But that's done now. We are going to be on the front page of the newspaper every day. We're going to be on your television. We're going to be on the radio. Utahns are going to see LGBT families now like never before, and their hearts are opening, and we're going to see this state shift. You watch it. You wait for it. It's happening, I promise you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Troy Williams.
Thank you. It's been great.
Again, I've been speaking with Troy Williams, who's the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He is a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune named as the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and is a producer of TLC's Breaking the Faith, which is about Mormon polygamous youth. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Republican success in killing health care reform at the state level. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Theda Scotchpole, who is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and the former president of the American Political Science Association. At Harvard, she has served as dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and as director of the Center for American Political Studies. She's the author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, and her latest research for the Scholar Strategy Network illustrates the impact of Republican obstruction of health care in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Theda Scotchpole.
Nice to be here.
And the study that you've done for the Scholar Strategy Network, I guess the main context here is that the Republicans at the national level have been obsessed with trying to kill Obamacare. They've had endless laws in the House in a futile effort to stop so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and they have been spectacularly unsuccessful. But what you're pointing out is that they've been very successful at the state level.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to see this as a two-pronged effort on the part of conservative Republicans. At the national level, they keep front and center the idea, which I don't think is true, certainly not while Barack Obama is in the White House, that affordable care could be repealed. But the law, as passed in 2010 and after the Supreme Court approved it, requires each of the 50 states to play a major role in carrying through the expansions of health coverage to millions of uninsured people, particularly lower-income people. And, you know, half the states, almost in every case where Republicans dominate, have refused to expand Medicaid to help more low-income people, working people in most cases, to be covered by Medicaid. And they're dragging their feet in many cases on helping people sign up on exchanges and get subsidies to buy private health insurance plans.
So what is the basic contrast between the 14 states that have expanded Medicaid and the 23 states that have refused to expand Medicaid and also set up the exchanges?
Okay, so I've classified all 50 U.S. states into five different groups, and you're right, the two extreme groups are 14 states that are both running their own exchange marketplaces, like Covered California in California, for example, and are moving ahead willingly and quickly to sign up more low-income people for Medicaid coverage. Those states are showing very rapid progress toward meeting the goals that experts set for covering more uninsured people under affordable care. The opposite extreme are 23 states that I call just say no states. These are states mostly run by Republicans that are not going to expand Medicaid, so they're leaving 5 million people out in the cold with no access to health insurance. And they're also dragging their feet on cooperating with signing people up on the exchange, in this case, the one that the federal government is trying to run for all the different states that didn't take up the job. Now, there are some states in the middle, too, and some of them are more supportive and some of them are less supportive. All of them have been held back on the exchange enrollments, in part because the federal government had too much to do and didn't do a very good job for the first 2 months.
So in terms of the states, and we're very aware of Governor Rick Perry of Texas opting out of Medicaid and calling Obamacare a criminal act, and it's probably no accident that only 14,000 people have signed up in Texas. What is there any other explanation apart from this sort of petty partisan ideology? It feels as though millions of Americans are being denied health care because of petty political spite.
Yeah, I don't think that conservative Republicans, and particularly ones that are trying to run for higher office, like Rick Perry of Texas, would see this as a petty struggle. I think from their point of view, it's a turning point because, you know, they think, well, if millions more Americans figure out that they can get health insurance coverage with the help of the federal government and this Affordable Care Act, which is actually a fairly moderate law, well, that's going to raise questions about the claim that Republican conservatives are putting forward that government can't do anything to help people. So I think in states like Texas, and Texas would really be at the top of the list of what I would call refusenik states, states that aren't just not helping, they're actually obstructing. They're trying to keep people from getting help to sign up for health insurance.
And that would apply to Florida as well, right? The governor down there.
Yes, I would say, though, that Florida's governor has been wobblier. He's one of a number of Republican governors around the country that have shown ambivalence, particularly about the money that the federal government wants to give the states to expand Medicaid. Because, after all, we're talking about here millions of dollars. In some cases, I think it goes even more than that. And it's money directly from the federal government that not only helps poor people in their states, it also helps hospitals remain solvent. So a fair number of governors, and Rick Scott of Florida is one of them, have said, well, maybe we can figure out a way to accept the Medicaid money. But Rick Perry is at the top of the list of those who said, no, I don't care. I don't care if it hurts our hospitals. I don't care if it denies coverage to poor people. He presides over a state in which one quarter of the citizens lack health insurance, and he's standing in the door of this law.
Again, I'm speaking with Theda Scotchpole, a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and the former president of the American Political Science Association at Harvard. She has served as dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and as director of the Center for American Political Studies, and is the author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Her latest research for the Scholar Strategy Network illustrates the impact of Republican obstruction on healthcare reform on Americans. Now, over the holidays, Theda, I had we had relatives staying, and there a couple with two 5-year-old twin boys who are both freelancers, and they were literally while I was working. The wife was on the phone with the California Exchange, and took her a while, but you know, she went through the steps and did it all on the online over the phone, and came out with like saving about $1,000 a month. I mean, it was amazing. You know that, you know, on the one hand, it was frustrating, the process, but on the other hand, the results were so, for a young family, was remarkable. I mean, so how is that going to translate? Is that happening around the country, that, you know, that what I witnessed anecdotally?
You know, it is, and I'm optimistic that as time passes, even in states where, unlike California, the authorities are not helping, really, or at least not the top authorities, I'm confident that as the months pass, more and more people will hear about, you know, a cousin or a friend or a neighbor who has finally cut through all of the public nonsense that's out there about the Affordable Care Act and checked out their options and discovered, as most would discover, that it's a very good deal for families of modest means and younger people. And these are the people who in the past haven't been able to get access to health insurance through their employment, or they've had some pre-existing condition or a child with a pre-existing condition and haven't been able to get access to a policy on the individual market at all that they could afford. So this is a huge transformation. It's also a big transformation that'll be harder for people to notice for those of us who do have good health insurance through our employers, because if something happens that we become unemployed, we're going to have options that we didn't have in the past. And all insurance companies now have to follow certain kinds of rules, like no limits on lifetime coverage, that mean a lot if someone in your family gets in a severe accident or is diagnosed with cancer.
So what about the invincible young then? Is, you know, I say, I was giving the example of how I've witnessed people saving like $1,000 a month. I mean, an amazing change and getting a much better deal and getting much, much more coverage that they never had before. But on the other hand, because of the rollout, the botched rollout, and I don't know whether the Koch brothers spending all that money on a phony AstroTurf group to encourage young college kids not to sign up, whether or not that worked. Advantage USA or something. I can't remember. Yeah. What about the invincible young? You teach at Harvard, so I mean, I guess those kids at Harvard may not be the most representative sample, but what's the sense of their enthusiasm or lack thereof of signing up?
Well, you know, millions of young people have already now for a couple of years been able to be kept on their parents' health insurance. And that's a big deal in colleges. I mean, my own son was able to stay on our health insurance plan for a couple of years after he graduated from college and before he started law school. So I think that's already known as something that people value. Now, beyond that, it's not so much that the young are invincible. I think the research shows that young people do understand that it's a good idea to have some health insurance coverage. And if they don't understand it, their mother will often tell them so, because after all, if something happens to a 20-year-old, guess who's going to be paying the bills if they're not insured? It's the issue here is that young people tend to put things off. A fair number of people, probably, you know, of young people, checked out the website in the early months, and in the states, particularly where it didn't work perfectly, or where the federal government bungled it for the first couple of months in the states that don't have their own exchanges, I think they found a frustrating experience, and that probably caused a lot of them to lay back. But we saw a surge of enrollments right at the end of the year. I think California has seen a surge of enrollments. And my understanding is that the preliminary California numbers are not too bad about signing up young people, but they are signing up.
Right.
And I think that's going to happen across the country, too. It just may be kind of, I'm a college professor, and I can tell you a lot of young people write that paper, you know, between midnight and 6
right.
a.m. on the last day, and I think that's what's going to happen with the sign-ups for Obamacare.
So is there then, given that there are examples and presumably through the grapevine and these examples of people really benefiting from the Affordable Care Act, trickle down. I don't know how that will happen in the states where the governors have denied the public any access or knowledge of how.
Well, they can't deny. No. I mean, they can't deny them any. They can deny them Medicaid in
right.
those states, but they can't deny people with kind of modest wages or a middle class income who don't have insurance at work. They can't deny those people access to the federally facilitated exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can drag their feet, not advertise very much, tell the insurance department employees that they shouldn't reach out. They can even take steps like Governor Perry has taken in Texas, which I think are really almost pathological, of trying to penalize private groups that want to help people find out about their options.
Mm-hmm.
But despite all of those things, I think by the late January, when the federal government issues its next statistics, we'll see that slower but steady progress in signing up people through the exchanges is occurring even in the deepest red states. And the way I think about that as a social scientist is this. You can have all kinds of political propaganda going on. You can have all kinds of things that scare people, like the idea of death panels, which just aren't true. But bit by bit, as individuals find out it's a good deal for them and tell their friends, tell their neighbors, tell their coworkers, the knowledge will seep through the population. And
well,
more and more people will say, well, maybe I better check this out because health insurance is really important to people.
Well, Theda Scotchpole, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Theda Scotchpole, who is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and the former president of the American Political Science Association. At Harvard, she has served as dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and as director of the Center for American Political Studies. She's the author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, and her latest research for the Scholar Strategy Network illustrates the impact of Republican obstruction on health care on Americans. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.